You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Hi, just a couple of housekeeping notes before we start. Although the Second City's live theater and live classes are not happening, we have turned everything virtual. You can take Second City classes in writing, in improv, and acting. There's a kids camp. We're also doing virtual corporate webinars and keynotes and workshops. It's all really kind of amazing, everything that we've been able to turn around. Plus, Second City is offering live improv shows on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. You can get all that information at www.secondcity.com. Check it out. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My returning guest today on Getting to Yes And is Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. Scott is a humanistic psychologist exploring the depths of human potential. He has taught courses on intelligence, creativity, and well-being at Columbia University, NYU, the University of Pennsylvania, and elsewhere. He is interested in using his research to help all kinds of minds live a creative, fulfilling, and self-actualized life. He hosts the Psychology Podcast, which has received over 10 million downloads and was named as 9 podcasts that will change how you think about human behavior by Business Insider. Kaufman's writing has appeared in The Atlantic, Scientific American, Psychology Today, and Harvard Business Review. He has authored many books, including Ungifted, Intelligence Redefined, and Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. But he has a new book. It's called Transcend, The New Science of Self-Actualization. Scott Barry Kaufman, welcome to the show.
Ah, so great to talk to you again.
All right, so we always do a check-in. You're in beautiful Santa Monica, California, correct?
Correct. That's correct.
I am here on the northwest side of Chicago in my home. We're recording on Zoom, which is what one does in a global pandemic. You doing okay?
I'm doing okay. Yeah, I am.
Yeah.
Yeah,
good,
trying to recycle myself every day.
Okay, that's a great way of putting it. So there's a tiny detail in this book that was actually a big surprise to me, and it's the fact that Abraham Maslow wasn't the one who put his famous hierarchy of needs into the form of a pyramid. That was actually created by a management consultant in the 60s.
Yeah. It really fit the ethos at the time with the man, the white man at the top of the flagpole.
Exactly.
With the business suit on, right? Mm-hmm. And actually, I think the first incarnation of it, it was a step ladder, you know.
Even worse.
Even worse. And then it became a pyramid, self-realization with a flagpole. So like it's an achievement, you know, you reach at the top there. That really betrays the original spirit of Maslow and his notion of what it means to be a self-actualized human. And also just the point of life is not to achieve a particular level of anything like a video game, but it's an experience. And life is a journey. He was very much more about the process than the outcome.
So I think most people have a general idea of the hierarchy of needs, but could you just do a quick cursory sort of this is what it is?
Absolutely. I mean, I was on a date the other day and the girl didn't know who Abraham Maslow was. And So I need to accept that this is not common knowledge.
Yes.
Be forgiving.
All right. I would love. So, all right. Can you recreate the moment when you had to explain it to your date?
It was actually interesting. But she's like, tell me about that. I was like, she's like, tell me what your new book's about. I was like, well, have you heard of Abraham Maslow? And she's like, no. So I was like, Do I want to continue this date? You know? But then I realized there's a lot of things in her field that I didn't know either.
Yeah,
so I explained it. So this is how I explained it to her, or how I explained it to anyone, which I don't assume everyone has heard of Maslow and his hierarchy of needs. But you probably have seen it diagrammed on Facebook, and you didn't even know where it came from. You've seen a triangle, a pyramid with toilet paper at the bottom, Wi-Fi added there at the bottom, battery life of your computer or phone as the most essential need. In Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which he never even drew a pyramid, but he argued we have a hierarchy of needs. Some needs are more prepotent. He used the word prepotent than others. That when they're deprived, they're more likely to take over the whole system, all that we are, and narrows our attention. So for instance, at the bottom you never do a pyramid, but his most prepotent need was the need for safe, need for physiological needs like food, shelter, water. And then above that, the need for safety, for having some level of predictability in your environment. And then above that, the need for connection and belonging. And then the need above that, the need for esteem from others as well as self-esteem. And then, as it's often depicted, you then just jump right up to self-actualization. You know, once you get all that, all those other goodies, then boop, you're becoming all that you're uniquely capable of becoming in life. Self-actualization is all about that sacred uniqueness within you. You know, these other basic needs are things we all share in common with each other and with other species. We're not unique as a species for caring about connection, you know, or safety, or even esteem. I mean, gorillas love esteem. They love that stuff. So if we say like, I need friends, that doesn't make me, you know, stand in line. It doesn't make me that special. But if I say I can play a violin concerto like no one else in the world can, you know, then we're talking, you know, now we're starting to talk about self-actualization. Is that sacred part of your soul that wants to be actualized?
So I was writing down notes when I was reading the book and the sort of early, I just wrote down, we are not fixed. So a lot of this book is talking about the fact that none of this doesn't really happen sequentially necessarily, and it doesn't mean that, like you were sort of alluding to, we achieve this enlightenment and we're done, the work's done, because the work is really never done. And you write in the book, quote, in my career, it has become clear that the more we have limiting notions of potential that are dictated by others, and you mentioned school teachers, parents, managers, etc., the more blind we become to the full potential of each and every unique individual. So this is that it's not just you putting limits, but when other people put limits on you early, that can really stunt your ability to sort of find this transcendence.
Oh, absolutely. And it could happen from getting a label in school that all of a sudden everyone in school sees you as that label. You know, like if someone has dyslexia, it's objectively one part of you. Yet in school, it feels like all there is to you. You know, in the environment of school, if you can't read or if you have difficulty reading, that you feel like your total being is deficient. That's how often a lot of kids feel who are in special education. So yeah, this reduction and the imposed expectations of others on us because we're such a social species really does limit our motivation for reaching towards the higher reaches of our own nature.
Yeah. So this, came true. It came full force to me this morning when I got up, I got some coffee, went outside. We have a rare, nice day. And my son, Nick, who just graduated college, had sent me his 24-page capstone paper. This is a kid who had a learning disability, could just a terrible speller. I am too. And had all this difficulty. This paper is on this new theory of his around millennial tragedy. I mean, it was amazing. It is noted as like a real academic paper. And you know, had he not lived in this sort of like yes and household where it was like the idea is, oh no, you mean you can kind of do anything, you know, where would he have been stuck? And you had that in your life too.
Oh, absolutely. I didn't realize until ninth grade that I could do anything. Mm-hmm. Well, I knew that I could do computer hacking because I did that in middle school.
Okay, good.
But I meant, you know, with mainstream illegal routes, like in school, that I could do anything. I didn't know that I was capable of learning. And I mean, talk about self schemas. You know, people were always wondering, can I change? Can I? How much can I change? How fixed is my state of being? You know, it's so fascinating for me to look at Scott SBK from grade zero to grade nine, and then SBK after grade nine. Yeah, grade nine, I don't have that many memories of it. And when I think of who I was, my identity, it feels amorphous. But then I think about after ninth grade, when I took myself out of special education, I felt empowered to see what I was capable of, and I joined the school orchestra, school choir. I started to develop a sense of self for the first time. And this is actually something I talk about in my book, is this tension between old Buddhist notions of, like, it's important to have no self. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm like, I'm not so sure about that. Like, that's a key characteristic of people with disintegrative personality disorders. Mm-hmm. You know, it's actually good to have a really good sense of who you are and your values, have a really firm sense of your values. It's actually a great thing. You know, and having a purpose and being driven by a future self is actually a wonderful thing. You know, it's not something that needs to be eradicated. You know, the LSD trip every now and then can be beautiful to completely lose yourself every now and then, but you don't want to walk it around in that state 24/7.
I'm interviewing tomorrow Irshad Manji, who has a new book called Don't Label Me, and she's a queer Muslim woman, and I saw no connection that with these books until, of course, I read them. And she's very much speaking to the need for all of us to escape our labels as ways that are they're limiting to us, and they don't let us grow. And we do this on all sides of the political spectrum. The side that doesn't think they do it is just, you know, the worst. And she has a very funny ongoing character, this guy Jim, who she lives next to, who's a Trump Republican, and she is not. And she's arguing with him in the car at one point. It's like, how is it that I can acknowledge my side's hypocrisy and you can never acknowledge your side's hypocrisy? And he takes a beat and he goes, bad habit. I feel like so much of this is just that. And one of the things I want to dig into with you is a little deeper into this idea of connection. So I think everyone has a very general idea of what we mean by when we say connection. You write in the book, quote, the need for connection actually consists of two sub-needs. A, the need to belong, to be liked, to be accepted. And B, the need for intimacy, for mutuality, for relatedness. Tell us what's going on there. What are these sub-needs, and how do they take us to a deeper understanding of what we mean when we say connection?
Yeah, my book is very nerdy. And so I you confirmed.
In a good way.
Well, thank you. I can't help, you know, even when I try my best to be poppy, I this is what you get. This is the book you get. Like, it's poppy, but it's also, I can't ignore key distinctions that I think are important levels of nuance. And one is that a lot of people in the field of psychology really try to lump together the need for, so they'll talk about the need for belonging as a basic human need, and not acknowledge that there's often, a lot of us are craving actual connection, but we're shooting for belonging in the hopes that it'll satisfy our intimacy, and we wonder why it never does. Mm-hmm. People may go their whole lives from one cult to the next, or one in the extreme violent extremism group, or even extreme political group, mm-hmm. or non-extreme political group, just whatever group, in the hopes that it will I'll belong somewhere. And what your reason why you're not getting your satisfaction is because you're not entering a relationship that is mutual. Mm-hmm. So you are only cared about by the guru or the leader of the group or the head of the political organization to the extent to which you agree with their views. It's not like there's a great mutuality there where they appreciate your whole being. So it's really important. There's no substitute for high quality connections in our lives, for friends who see and respect and accept our whole being independent of who they are and their own beliefs and their whole being, where their needs become your needs. There's something very beautiful about that connection that nothing can replace it. And it's amazing the contortionist acts people go through in trying when that's what they really want, but instead they search for the esteem need, thinking some will even become president of the United States or whatever. I'm not thinking of any specific example, but they'll keep climbing the social status hierarchy ladder because they think more and more people love me, more and more people love me. And then they get to the top and they're like, why am I so unfulfilled? You know, like so many people love me. Why am I? They're not loving you. Really you, you mm-hmm. know, they're loving the extent to which you're helping them or, you know, your ideas, your ideologies. So that's why. So it's, you know, things we go through so many contortionist acts to satisfy what we really want. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and there's a real threat on the other side of this, which is the scourge of loneliness. And this has now been studied, right? When you have a stat in here where there was a study of the happiest 10% of college students, and the one characteristic stood out that they all enjoyed a highly fulfilling social life. I actually asked Nick about that, my son. He's like, yep, that's completely true. And he talked about the fact that there were, on his campus, definitely people who were lonely, and that's a scary thing, right? That can lead people down a really dark place.
Yeah, and you know why? In a lot of ways, there's new by Rebecca Sachs and colleagues, new psychological research showing that people who are chronically lonely or deprived of connections, it turns into a vicious cycle because they become much less motivated to meet new people. You know, this is how our brain works in a way. At a certain point, you have enough defeat, our brain just accepts it and shuts down and isn't receptive to new opportunities for growth. And so that's really unfortunate when you get into a situation where this vicious cycle happens amongst kids, where they isolate themselves, they start to create fantasy worlds in their head, maybe they start playing shooter video games. Just this sense of alienation from others, and then others pick up on, well, that student is weird or whatever, so they treat them a certain way. And I mean, there's research showing, this might sound controversial, but there's research showing that the targets of bullies have particular characteristics, and that's not victim blaming, that's called understanding, it's called science, right? Mm-hmm. And it's certainly not blaming the victim of the bully, but it's a tragic thing that you know, there are certain characteristics that bullies are picking up on. Certain people who are lonely or needy or socially awkward or isolated, where we don't provide them in school with the things they really need to help them connect to the world, it becomes a very vicious cycle.
I don't know if Anne's talked to you about this. Has she ever talked to you about the thing that they do at the end of her comedy semester called Pizza and Crying?
No.
Oh, so what they do at the end of the comedy study session, so that's the semester where these groups all been together and they've learned all this different stuff. They have all the teachers and all the students together. They get pizza, and then they one by one tell the student what is amazing about them, and also what challenges they might need to pick up on. And this last session, I remember the very first day of class, Anne's like, I have a human cartoon who is in this class. This girl is like, she just talks like a cartoon. She goes, I think she might be brilliant. Good, she is weird. And what happened was, you know, it can go one of two ways. The ensemble can either push someone out, like you're talking about, or if they're really following the rules of improv, they bring them in. And that's what this group did. They all decided that she was brilliant. She would be the center. And so when it came time to talk about her, and everyone's talking about how amazing she is, she's crying and basically saying, my whole life, I've been pushed out. I was the weird kid. This is the only place in my life where I've ever been celebrated for just being who I am.
I love that so much.
It's the best.
It really is. And so much of my career has been zooming in on those kids, you know.
Yep.
And it's weird because even before I studied it scientifically, I think maybe I was – would it sound immodest to me to say destined to do what I'm doing today? Because when I was, I'm trying to think of a better word than destined, but when I was a really young kid, I always was scanning the playground for the kid who was, you know, in the corner kind of reading a book to themselves. And, you know, I would you're like, hey, you want to be friends? Like, those are the people I was attracted to for some reason. Maybe, I don't know, maybe because I was like that as well. But, you know, I just think there's so much potential that we squash because people don't fit a very standard mold.
100%. All right, let's talk about healthy self-esteem, because this is an interesting area where you break down the various ways.
Paper on this.
You just published a paper on it?
Yeah. Oh.
I didn't read that. I just read the book. I'm a busy man.
Of course.
You write in the book, quote, the most important attitude we may have maybe is the attitude we have towards ourselves. So where does like egotism fit in this, narcissism and healthy self-esteem? How do we get to it being healthy or not healthy?
So there's healthy self-esteem. There's also healthy selfishness.
Mm.
But that's the paper we just published on healthy selfishness. Okay. Well, so unhealthy self-esteem is narcissism.
Yeah.
And that's a kind of self-esteem where it's so dependent on the validation of others. There's different kinds of narcissism. There's a more introverted kind of narcissism that many people might not see so evidently. But there's the more extroverted, puffed up, you know, puff the chest, I'm the greatest form of narcissism.
I can't think of anyone who fits that label.
Right. Exactly. So usually with the puffed up version of narcissism called grandiose narcissism in the psychological literature, you see an obsession with greatness is actually in the psychological literature. That's what you see is they're just, this person's obsessed with everything has to be about winning and domination. That's what everything is about. Power, money, domination. That's it's like their broken record.
Winners and losers. Winners and losers. Winners,
like,
and losers.
It's like, is there anything else that you ever in your consciousness?
Apparently not.
And that's grandiose narcissism. But then vulnerable narcissism is an interesting, goes under the radar sometimes. And you see that from some school shooters and things. Students who are humans, people that are more introverted, they actually want to be grandiose narcissists, but they don't have the extroversion to do it. So they get even more frustrated. It's interesting. It's usually the school shooters who are the vulnerable narcissists. The grandiose narcissists are more likely to become presidents and not hurt people so overtly, you know, like that they hurt them in a different way, if you know what I mean. Uh-huh. But, you know, vulnerable narcissists are more introverted. They're so frustrated. They lack the skills to enact the vision of themselves they see in their heads that become so frustrating for them. Okay, that's unhealthy narcissism. That was just a deep dive, mini deep dive into narcissism as a construct. But the problem isn't with self-esteem itself. The problem is with the pursuit of self-esteem. There's a good quote for you. the good Twitter line.
Yep.
But look, we want a self-esteem that where we feel like we have a stable sense of self, that we feel like we're worthy. We feel like we're competent, that we have some sort of pride over real actualized things that we do. There's nothing wrong with feeling that. In fact, I argue it's a need. It's a need to have a stable sense of self and self-esteem. Again, the problem is with this unhealthy manifestation of it, where you become an addiction. I put it within an addiction model in my book. You become addicted to self-esteem.
Right.
Where that is what, so there's no problem with self-esteem. The problem is with addiction to self-esteem. Make sense?
Yeah. And you write in the book, quote, stop walking through the world looking for confirmation that you don't belong. And I think that's a classic thing that I see people who, you know, otherwise really good, smart, talented people. It's always that thing where it's like, why is this person getting in their own way? You know, and that's the ultimate thing, because it's like they are the only thing standing in their way. And it's quite frankly often just their mindset, the way they're framing their experiences. And that's just a terrible thing to watch happen in front of you.
Yes. And it's usually it's because you entered this mode of the hierarchy winning mode of cognition is usually that activates, you know. And because look, this happens to me. It happened to me this morning.
So
there was a particular individual who has more accolades and things, and I try so hard. I meditate on it. Doesn't bother me. But then every now this person will like like thank someone, like praise someone else, you know, when they, mm-hmm. they could have praised me or they could have acknowledged the work I did or whatever. And I mm-hmm. suddenly like, I feel insecure all of a sudden and mm-hmm. it activates in me this, like this suddenly the ego or something is active. This part of me that I don't like this part of me. Yeah. And so then I go back to the cushion and I'm like, oh, I meditate on this. But it doesn't, just because I meditated, it doesn't mean that it didn't still happen to me, you know. Like, I think it's really important for psychologists and people who study this stuff to not act as though they're above, you know, these kinds of things. Like this one person, I'm not going to mention this person on air, but there's only this one person who, for some reason, they keep triggering in me this feeling, and I want to finally understand why I don't have this feeling. And whenever I have a feeling, it's just this ego that comes out that I don't like.
All right, so your truth telling, I'll tell you mine, because I had a similar situation. Like I'm a pretty even person, and mm-hmm. I got so like messed up on Friday because I was reaching out to a Hollywood agent to get an actress to do this program that we're working on. And mm-hmm. I wrote her name down wrong in the email. And it was this big chain email and person's like, actually her name is this. And I was requesting something. This is like something you never do. And I just felt like everything welled up in me where I this chain kept going and going, and I moved it over to other colleagues. I basically went, save me from this. And I kept, every time an email would come in, I had to take it out of my inbox. I was like, I can't even look at it. And it just like dogged me. And I'm like, what am I doing? I made a mistake, and I doubt they're, and by the way, this person's going to do the thing for us anyway. But it was like, I'm telling you, I spun for not a short period of time.
Yeah. Yeah. And some of these things can get triggered in us at, you know, it's such a primal subcortical structure level. You know, this is a fascinating thing when you start looking at the organization of the brain.
Yeah.
And you realize that the default response is often these things coming from these automatic implicit areas of our brain. It takes a lot of training and a lot of work to overcome them, but doesn't mean that every now and then it's gonna slip through the prefrontal cortex filter. Right. That's a funny way, a really nerdy way of putting it, but every now and then things are going to slip through the prefrontal cortex filter. And when that happens, we shouldn't beat ourselves up over it. Even though I did beat myself up over this morning, then I was like, why I teach this stuff? Why can't I just not, why can I not let it bother me? Well, there are some things that just, you know, it's part of who we are that like it'll bubble up. But I think just, you know, training with kindness, self-compassion is so important.
Yeah, totally. I want to talk a bit. You were the one who introduced me to the term post-traumatic growth. This section in the book that talks about turning adversity into advantage. And I was really intrigued by the idea that sometimes it's this adversity that actually is the thing that pushes you into the sort of move towards growth. So talk to us a bit about that, because I think that was a little surprising.
Yeah. As I've been putting it lately under the COVID sort of context, I think we underestimate the extent to which purpose often comes from challenge. Mm-hmm. That's where our purpose comes from. And a lot of people, when they get a challenging situation or they or things become too hard to cope, some people will fall apart. It certainly, that response can happen. But you also see in a sizable number of people that it causes them to have a renewed sense of clarity over what matters to them the most in life and what doesn't matter to them as much, and what they're just doing to please others versus what they really truly want to do and what they want to realize. And often they put it in as motivation. It actually acts as the motivation. A really great example of this is if you watch the Last Dance documentary, mm-hmm. Michael Jordan, he was really good throughout his career in creating this person who was a child. I hate this person all of a sudden. And he would sometimes invent things in his way, roadblocks, so that it would motivate him to jump over them. Could you imagine his career, what it would have been like if he, there was no trauma in his head at all for anything. Everything was just him just going on there and just dunking over everyone. You know, it was such a motivating force for him, these sort of challenges. And the other, we should all kind of treat that.
Moist. Yeah. One of the things that was interesting here too is I had always sort of treated the concept of rumination as being a negative thing. And you actually have an idea here that it isn't necessarily that. And sometimes that's a thing that allows us to move through these experiences in healthy ways when we're able to sort of ruminate, as long as we're doing this while having a good, like, sort of connected force around us.
Oh yeah.
That was definitely my experience in terms of any difficult stuff that happened in my life.
Yeah, and you've really gone through some real traumas.
Mm-hmm. But I think Scott, the thing about it is, in going through that, writing every day and sharing that writing was for me a huge part of the sort of grief journey and healing process.
Yeah, I don't know if you read the quote by Harold Kushner when he lost his son. The quotes in the book. I think it's a really profound quote. I can try to find it real quick.
Yeah, do. That was obviously an interesting part for me to read about, but also, like, it certainly brought up all those feelings of what, you know, when you go through something like this and you think you can't get to the other side, and then you recognize that by the doing, by the constantly sort of moving forward thoughtfully, again, because I have a network, a strong network that I can rely on.
Absolutely, and you also realize that life goes on for you.
Yeah.
Let me read this quote as I hit decline on my friend who's calling me. Just decline, and I'll explain to them later why I hung up on them. But Rabbi Harold Kushner put it well as he reflected on the death of his son. He said, "I am a more sensitive person, a more effective pastor, a more sympathetic counselor because of Aaron's life and death than I would ever have been without it. And I would give up all those gains in a second if I could have my son back. Mm-hmm. If I could choose, I would forgo all the spiritual growth and depth which has come my way because of our experiences. But I cannot choose." And so I find that a very poignant quote that just grips me, my emotional soul. And you realize that, what choice, you can help others. You can spread messages of that people would want, like your child would want the world to hear. And you can still be in a position to do these things. And post-traumatic growth, it just doesn't mean that you prefer the trauma, you prefer that it would have happened. I think it's a misconception. I sometimes can get pushback from social justice activists, say things like, post-traumatic growth, it's, you're saying it's better to not have, you're excusing, almost saying, like, things that are unjust or unfair are good.
Right.
And no, it's not saying that these things are good.
Mm-hmm.
But it's saying, what fodder can it be for a motivating force for good?
Mm-hmm. Two more things I want to touch on before I'm going to ask you for another yes and story. I know you've done it before, but I'll make you think of one at the end. Talk to us about the dark triad and the light triad. I found that a fascinating section of the book.
Yeah, I've been continuing doing research on that, and we actually have a new study coming out soon, which I can tell you some of the findings of it. Mm-hmm. But the dark triad has been studied. I just got a voicemail. Why do you hang up on me? We're not friends anymore.
At least it's not that person you're ruminating on.
Yeah, exactly. So what the hell is it talking about? Okay. So the dark triad is something in the literature that comprises narcissism, Machiavellianism, and psychopathy.
Yeah.
These are three dark things that you have. If you're the all three of these things, and people have lately, they've added they used to call it the tetrad, the dark tetrad. They added everyday sadism into the mix. So let's say you have those four things. That's really dark. That's been studied for years. My colleagues and I were curious, like, is there anything interesting about people who aren't assholes? Like, can we study the everyday saint? Mm-hmm. Are everyday saints worth studying? And we found they are. We found that they, that in fact, if you want to live a life of very high life satisfaction and meaning and connections with others, cultivating these light triad characteristics we identified will be more probabilistically for those outcomes. And the light triad consists of humanism, treating people with dignity, every individual you meet with dignity and respect. Kantianism, treating people as ends in themselves, not means to an ends. And faith in humanity, believing that humans are basically good, even though you recognize that they're imperfect. And our new study found support for that, by the way. We looked to see if we could classify how many percentage of within people, like light versus dark characteristics and the balance. What are most people? What are most humans? We looked at thousands and thousands of the population, and we found that only 7% are extremely malevolent, are like predominantly dark within themselves. Now, that 7% can wreak havoc on a society.
Sure.
Which is fascinating. But most people were a mix of, and were even more tipped to the light side, slightly. I wouldn't say that most people are predominantly everyday saints, most people were a mix with hilt towards the light side. And I think there's hope there about humanity, you know. Even though the crime dramas on TV all focus on serial killers, I have just often wondered, are only serial killers interesting?
No. Well, I think the answer to that is no. So the other thing that was amazing is you cite this 75-year Harvard study by, it's George Valiant, is that his name?
Yes, absolutely.
And this, of course, I pulled out this quote, the use of humor to allow one to cope and yet still focus on the job that needs to get done. This is a support for humor as being important to self-action.
So glad you pointed that out, because whenever I'm asked these days on shows or whatever, you know, how can you cope? Keep humor about it and keep your self-humor. You know, don't take yourself so seriously. There is some research showing that in the brains of budding psychopaths, so young kids with those traits that might develop in a psychopathy, when all the other kids are laughing, they're not laughing. And I think it's really interesting new research showing just how core laughter and humor is to being human, to social connectedness, to so many aspects of the good life.
Well, and so much around, you know, my wife Anne's upstairs working on her comedy book that's due.
Oh, I said hi.
I will. So there, you know, so much about comedy is a realization of a truth, a sort of a surprise truth. And there's importance there. And I think what happens is that because it's comedy, somehow a lot of people think it's less important, when really what we're talking is another way. Well, it's all of arts, right? It's a way to reflect back to us the important things, the true things, the things that maybe we obfuscate or, you know, just walk by. I think it serves a great purpose.
Here, here. And I mean, also stand-up comedians, and I'm wanting to start getting into stand-up comedy a little bit, because I have so many thoughts in my head that I can't get out in a scientific paper, but I can get out in that realm. but thanks, Alexa. Alexa's telling me to drink water.
Okay.
Yeah, I heard you the first time, Alexa.
All right, better drink the water then.
It's amazing. She's never repeated herself before. Like, she's getting really...
She knows you need water.
She's getting really stern with me. She's like, I don't care if you're in a podcast. Humor also serves the function... I want to hear what you're going to say, but humor is so important right now in an age of post-truth.
Yeah.
You know, we need people who... there's always it seems to be a germ of truth to a lot of things we find automatically humorous, even if our prefrontal cortex then, you know, humor is one of the great ways of letting our slip through the cracks of the prefrontal cortex, to use my earlier metaphor.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and also the different delivery, the way we deliver comedy is different in these different genres. So in improvisation, of course, you have an ensemble that's working together and they're sort of in cahoots with the audience. And when Anne talks about stand-up comedy, she talks about comedians are perspective givers first. So they have to give the audience a way to understand them in a very quick way so that they can then relate to their comedy and begin to settle in and have that experience. But it's much more of a cat and mouse exchange with the audience than an improv thing, which is like, we're all in this together.
Yeah, that's true. especially if your jokes are at the expense of an out-group or something.
Yeah, well, you're right, exactly. So, I mean, this is like when people I've been interviewed so many times as like, is Trump funny? And I'm like, well, Trump uses comedy, but he's using it for nefarious purposes. He uses it to, make someone outside the group, or, and that, he's more of insult comedy, than anything else. Obama was funny, as well, but the opposite. He used it as a way to, a lot of sort of making fun of himself. All the way Michelle would talk to him, or he'd tell stories on himself. And it's just it's a different way of creating an in-group. One, I think has got, I think the intent is different. Pretty clear.
Sure. And I talk in the book about, maybe it was in a footnote, B humor versus D humor.
Yeah.
Deprivation based motivated humor versus growth oriented humor. So that's a perfect example.
Yeah. Okay, so we always, and you did this before, we always end the podcast with asking our guests for a yes and story, a time in your work or life where you normally would have said no, but instead you said yes and. Do you have a moment you can sum up for us?
Okay, I'll admit it. This Wednesday, I'm going to be on the Ledger Report. Which okay. is the most, what's his name, John Oliver recently posted that as the biggest Trump supporting thing in the world. And I think this is actually a good example of yes ending. Mm-hmm. We'll see how it goes. And I'm a little bit shy to even, I wasn't going to mention to anyone that it's going to happen, because if it's such a colossal, embarrassment for me, then I didn't want to hope that it never would show up. But I'm going through with it. And my original gut reaction was like, why would I ever want to talk to the Ledger? But then I listened and channeled you, and everything you've ever said to me and everything you taught me. And I was like, I'm just going to get on the show and do yes and.
Yeah.
And no matter what he says, I'm going to just yes end it. I'm not going to get in a fight, And
what do they want to talk to you about? The book or a single subject matter?
Well, they want to talk about post-traumatic growth. He liked the okay. idea of post-traumatic growth and the idea of we have a lot of resiliency and the psychological toll of this pandemic on us.
Okay.
So we'll see. But that somehow seems like a good example, don't you think?
It's a very good example. And again, like Irshad, who I'm interviewing tomorrow, talks about this, of like, if we're not – the only way we're going to get through this, all of this, is together. I mean, and there's some group of us together. People need other people to move culture forward. It just doesn't it doesn't happen by magic. And this idea of us basically civil warring everything is also not speaking to the truth of the situation we're in. Yes, there are extremists. They've always existed. But I think as your sort of studies go, they're rarely, like never the majority. Everyone else is kind of in this like mix, this weird mix. So, she very much promotes the idea that people of differing views sit down and at least try to give it a talk. And if you can do it, this is like, it's yes and, but it's also the idea around thank you because, where if you show some gratitude for someone, usually they will then assume some goodwill on your part. And then if you can find points of agreement, you have a chance of actually staying inside a really, really difficult conversation.
Oh, I love that. Thank you. Because what you just said was beautiful.
The book is called Transcend, The New Science of Self-Actualization. Scott Barry Kaufman, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
million feet.
Survive.